session number 10398, reel 6.
This is Pomeroy, reel 6.
Arthur Savage said, you must not come in your fancy clothes. Wear your most faded dress and wear your bakya. And by bakya, he knows, he already has picked up this word bakya, which means wooden slippers or wooden shoes. Because the laundress women wear wooden shoes when they come to the camp. Because the GIs give their clothes to the laundry women, and they are paid generously. You know, they can just come in and out of the camp, because all the GIs do not want to wash their own clothes, you see. So it's a very good excuse for me to go in there like a lavandera. Lavandera means a laundry woman. He also knows this word lavandera. You know? He told me, come like a lavandera. So he set the date and the time. It was a Sunday. And when we came to this camp, we found nobody but just Arthur Savage. He said, I had all my personnel go out and have a good time, he says, so that nobody will be in the office, in the headquarters, except myself. And there was our truck, you know. I don't know what he was going to give us. But I had three comrades with me, men comrades. And he said, take this. You know, the truck was full. Do you know what were given to us? Mimeograph machine, about 6 typewriters, books and books and books, clothes, GI clothes, you know, the clothes the GIs, food, tinned foods, all paraphernalia that are useful, reams of paper, stencils, carbon paper. He gave me a beautiful sewing kit, you know, with all kinds of thread and a complete set. And he gave me a set of books, says, this is just for you. And these are Marxist-Leninist books. I said, oh, Arthur, you are going to donate your office. Don't worry about it. And my God, our truck was full of all sorts of things, shoes, mosquito nets, and all sorts of things that he could find there. And then he came with us. He came to the office. And when we were sitting in the truck, I said, do you have any qualms of conscience about what you've done? He said, why should I? He says, I'm working for socialist democracy. He says, my God, don't you know what these imperialists are doing to your country? They're looting your country, and all I'm giving you are crumbs. I have no qualms of conscience. If I can give you more, I'll give you more. But this is what I can do at present. And my whole heart is in this, he said. I thought that really touched me very much. This man is, is a great man. And he became a very good friend of our party, this man. And when we came to our office, my God, our general secretary was just startled. He didn't know what to say. He didn't expect it, you know. Well, after this, I met other GIs, and then some of them suggested that they would like to see the Hook guerrillas in person, you know, disarmed guerrillas in person. And since I've come to know them and have learned to trust them because of the way they speak and their understanding of the situation in the Philippines, then I organized it. I made contact with Comrade Juan Feleo, who is a peasant leader in Nueva Ecija.
Juan who?
Juan Feleo. J-U-A-N, and his surname is F-E-L-E-O. Juan Feleo now is a hero of our movement because he was killed by the Philippine army during the course of this time. But at that time, he was the head of the cultural groups that gave performances in the villages during the Japanese occupation. Now, Juan Feleo, we are two jeeps of I was the only woman, and the others were all GIs. Six GIs came with me. We went to Kabanatuan. This is the capital of Nueva Ecija. Nueva Ecija is our stronghold, the stronghold of the Hooks, the stronghold of the Communist Party. The capital of is Kabanatuan, and Juan Feleo met us there and took us to a restaurant and had a talk. We had a good talk there. So I told Comrade Juan Feleo why these GIs came with me. I told him that I've already told him in a letter, I'm just reiterating it to him at that moment, that they would like to see the armed guerrillas themselves because they're so curious, you know. How do they look? What do they do? What are their occupations? What are they doing now? You know, things like that. So he arranged it. He was in a car, and then he led the way to Cabiao. Cabiao is the most organized town in Nueva Ecija. Organized in the sense that it is strongly influenced by the Hook Balahap and by our party. Then we went into the village. In the village, there is a nipa hut. A nipa hut is a peasant house made of thatch roof, small one. They knew we were coming, and they've laid out a feast for the GIs, you know. Well, the idea of the peasant, of the peasants in the villages when they want to give a feast to people who are coming, is to lay out on a big table banana leaves, and then they put the plates there, and you are supposed to eat on the banana leaves, you know, and you have to eat with your hands. But they have fancy food already prepared, you know. Our national dish is the roast pig with a very, very tasty sauce. And this was served, and there were lobsters, there were oysters, there were fish, there were all kinds of food that the peasants think their guests would like. So we had a good time eating. And then they had prepared a band, you know, a string band, all Filipino
instruments.
And this band played while we were eating. And after we have eaten, the women were called in their native dresses, and they gave a performance for the GIs, you know, this folk dance. Very beautiful, because they were dressed in very picturesque clothes, you know. I will show you some the Filipino attire later on. Then about 3 o'clock, we went into the fields. We just walked to the fields. And when we were in the middle of the field, all at once, we were surrounded by these armed men. And they were barefooted. They were dressed in very poor attire, but they had guns, pistols, guns, garands. What you call armalites,
automatic
rifles. Well, because these GIs already knew that they would meet these guys, they were not afraid. So they were gathered together. They only sat on the field, no benches. And this comrade Justin Vanderlaan was asked to address them. So I acted as his interpreter, because he cannot speak Filipino, and the Hook Balahap guerrillas who were there could not understand English. You know, they are poor peasants. Some of them are even illiterate. So he gave a 10-minute speech, which was very rousing and very inspiring to the peasant guerrillas. And at the same time, after that, Comrade Juan Feleo spoke. He's a very, very eloquent orator, this comrade Juan Feleo, in answer to Justin Vanderlaan's speech. And then one of the commanders of the squadron spoke also. Well, this was a very interesting interlude, and the GIs apparently enjoyed it very much. after this, we must have gone home around 6 o'clock. They enjoyed it very much. And out of this, Justin Vanderlander wrote a piece for the People's Daily World describing this whole experience of theirs, which they found very fascinating. He even showed me the, when it was published, he showed me a copy of this newspaper that contained this article. And out of this episode was born an idea that our revolutionary song should be recorded. And Justin Vanderland did that. He arranged things so that one day this string band and the singers were called and they... and their songs were recorded. I received a copy of this recording, and this was all done between Justin Vanderland and Juan Fileo. They did the, they organized it, you see. And this to me was very fruitful, this visit, because it produced an article and it produced the making of a record, which we never even thought about, you know, at that time. Our revolutionary songs were recorded. The songs that were sung by Diuk Balhap during that period of the Japanese occupation. Then the things began to get worse. I had to go deeper and deeper underground because they were already hunting for the most prominent leaders of Diuk. In fact, Juan Fileo was killed. He was asked to embark on a pacification campaign by the president, President Rojas. Pacify the peasants, you know, no more fighting. We don't want any more fighting, he said. Pacify them and tell them we want peace. But in the course of the campaign, when Juan Fileo was going on this campaign, he was killed by the army itself who were guarding him. He was in an army jeep. And they massacred him. Well, of course, this aroused the ire of our people, especially the guerrillas. Later on, about 3 months later, one of the leaders of the Congress of Labor Organizations, whose name is Manuel Hoven, he is one of the trade union leaders, he was asked to come to a place outside the city to organize a group of workers so that they could compose a trade union. And when he went there, he was killed too. He was killed by the army. Now, these two episodes to us was already a bad sign.
Which year would this have been?
This is 1946, right after the war. Manuel Rojas has just been elected as the president of the Philippines. But what Manuel Rojas did is a mailed fist policy against the Hooks and against the peasants who supported the Hooks and who supported the Communist Party of the Philippines. During that period, terrible burning of houses in the areas where we were strong, in Kandating, in places like Concepcion. I can't remember the names now, but at that time I knew what villages were burned. If you have read Bill's book Born of the People, he enumerates them there. What villages were burned at that time? Hundreds, you know. And the lives of people in Central Luzon were dislocated. The people were impoverished because they have to go here, go there, evade the soldiers, and in fact, so many of the children, you know, the sons of the Hook guerrillas who were killed became Hook Balhap members themselves, as a sort of revenge for the killing of their fathers or their brothers. In fact, we gained more adherents at that time, more followers, because of the mailed fist policy of President Manuel Rojas. In fact, at the beginning, when this was happening, there was even a contingent, a group of peasants, together with some Democratic Alliance politicians, who went to Malacañang. Malacañang is the palace of the president. and had a talk with President Rojas with certain demands, you know, written, these as our demands. Well, President Rojas received them very politely, but he did nothing about the request. In fact, the suppression became even more intense. And what was left for the Oaks to do? We had to regroup. The guerrilla comrades had to get back their arms, and they formed units in the villages. And I think the situation was we were pushed against the wall. We had nothing to do but to retaliate. Otherwise, we will not survive. We'll all be killed. And at the time, I was going back and forth to the provinces because sometimes I had to convey messages from the Politburo. And I could see the situation. I was so distressed, dismayed by what I saw, you know. The dislocation of the lives of these people. They could not even work in the fields. They were frightened. And they were a group of people in the villages whose houses were burned. They will be moved to another village, and that village becomes crowded, and the people there complain. They don't have enough food for these people who have just come in. And, you know, this led to the rearming again of the Hukbalahap. This time, we changed the name, because Hukbalahap means the People's Army against Japan. Now we call this the People's Liberation Army, which in Filipino is Hukbong Mapagpalaya ng Bayan. I will explain that to you later. We had a big meeting in which it was a hard decision to take, you know, whether we shall embark on an armed guerrilla struggle or we shall continue with our parliamentary struggle. And it was decided in that meeting, I cannot remember the date anymore, but it's sometime 1947, I think. The decision was to be an armed struggle, a skillful combination of the armed struggle and the parliamentary and legal struggle. At that time, I had changed my position. I was given another position. I was no longer the head of the youth, because I felt I was beyond 30. You see, I'm no longer young. I said, I would like to do something else, and this is my own request. I said, I would like to see the women's organization, the pre-war women's organization, revived, and I'm willing to do this myself. I said, because at that time there was no women's organization. There was a women's organization before the war, but it was it at first it had a low profile, but the women joined the Hukbalahap. Those women who were members of the Women's League of the Philippines, I think the name was, because they are wives of the peasant guerrillas. They also joined the guerrilla movement. I met many of them during the Second World War. And because I'm familiar with many of them, I thought, why shouldn't we have a women's movement? At that time, I have read Lenin's book about the emancipation of women. I have read the book of Clara Zetkin called The Woman Question. And I was so fired, you know, with enthusiasm to lead a women's movement in the Philippines. Well, the General Secretary and the members of the Politburo acceded to my request, and he said, well, you form your own, I was to become the head of the women's division. You form your own group, and he says, and you just report to us what you intend to do, and put it in writing, they said. So I began a group. There were five of us. This is the women's division of the Communist Party. Now, of the five of us, I'm the only one whom you may call an intellectual. The other women came from peasant stock, and many of them have not even reached high school, but they are political, you know. So I said, what I think we should do is we should have a women organization in Manila among the professionals or the intellectuals, and we should have a peasant women's organization. Now, I'll take care of the women's, the women intellectuals. The four of you take care of the of organizing the peasant women. So, with the help of just two friends of mine, who are not communists but who are very progressive, we formed a group, and then we are, each of us will bring a friend, you know. So we became six. That became the steering committee of an organization which we call the Women's Forum. Now, my own idea of the Women's Forum is that we are not going to do anything really spectacular. The women, as I see in the Philippines, are so subservient to the men. You know? And they do not play, although some women were prominent, especially business women. Some women were prominent, have key positions in the government or are well known as business women. But the great majority of the women were subservient to the men. You know, were just, they attended to family affairs. They brought up children. They took care of the household needs. But they were not involved in community work or in nation building. And I thought at that time that the women of the Philippines must play an important role in this country. And we can start bit by bit, you know, by forums, explaining to women what their role should be. That they must not be subservient, that they must develop themselves. That there is a certain potential among women which has not been tapped. And if they engage in community work, if they play a salient role in the running of the nation's affairs, then they will develop themselves and they will become also pillars of society just as men are. And I had a hard time explaining this to members of the party. In fact, I remember a meeting we had. This already came about in 1951. I'm going too far. But I remember giving a lecture to our men comrades, you know, about the woman question. And I was so enthusiastic about my own feelings about this thing that I must have overdone it because I became very critical of the men. And I think I did not make a very positive impression because I was too angry. I was blaming the men for the women's subservient role in society. But then Bill was already my husband at that time, and Bill was the one who afterwards who delivered a speech, you know, and his speech was really excellent because he did not criticize anybody. He just gave a sort of a theoretical lecture about what the role of women should be in the Philippines, and he cited Lenin and he cited Clara Zetkin. What Lenin said about women, what Clara Zetkin said about women, which was more educational for our comrades, but mine is emotional, you see. So I didn't think I make much headway there.
So how did Bill's speech go down with the other comrades?
It went down very well, because he's a man. He's a man. I'm a woman. I'm speaking in defense of the women, you know. But here's a man speaking in defense of women. And he was not criticizing anybody. He was just explaining what the important role that women could play in our own party and in the movement, in the struggle against, in the struggles against imperialism. He says, you know, there are many intelligent women who have not, whose potentialities have not been tapped. And if they are activized in the party and in the struggles, you will find how very useful and how valuable are their contributions. He was excellent. And later on, Bill suggested to me that when we write in our theoretical organ, which we call Communist, I must talk about the woman question. Every time the issue of the Communist came out, I will dwell on the woman question. And since he's the editorial corrector, my emotional outbursts. Well, the women's organization, women's organizations were formed. One is the Women's Forum, and at first it went very slowly, you know. But then I was the secretary, and one friend is the chairwoman, and the other friend is, I don't know whether I should give you their names, but because they are not communists. And my other friend is the vice chairwoman. And between the three of us, we decided what issues to take up. And so one of the things we thought would be interesting to women is the lowering of the prices of food and goods. Because that has something to do with the shopping by women. Then we thought of price control. And we lobbied Congress, you know, when we had this. And then in Manila, there is a section of Manila which is a slum area. It's called Palomar. It's in Palomar district. And we have many comrades living there, communists living there. They're very poor. And one of our members said, why don't we make Palomar a project? Did you notice this? With 5,000 people there, they have only two artesian wells. All the people in that whole area get water from these two artesian wells. And he says, and you should see the toilets. They stink. The public, there are no toilets in the homes. There are only toilets here, toilets there, but they stink. And they're awful condition. Slummy, muddy, you know, the whole place. And the people live in what you call barong-barong. Barong-barong are cardboard boxes, you know. The roofs are made of cardboard, and the walls are made of paper. You should go into that place. I tell you, you'll feel depressed. And what is lucky for us is one of our members, whose name is Mary Vita Beltran, is a nurse who works in St. Luke's Hospital. And St. Luke's Hospital is right next to this Palomar district. And she could understand what I would say about the Palomar district. And she said to us, I think we should drive for a clinic in the Palomar district so that especially the women and children could be given some advice as to, you know, their ailments.